I'd like to thank Professor Lee for inviting me here and helping make possible this trip both to your university and to the conference a few days ago, World Resources Forum 2012. I really enjoyed that and enjoyed my interactions with Professor Lee. This is a presentation of new physical models for the carbon fuel cell. A little background here. This idea is not terribly new, the carbon fuel cell. It goes back nearly 100 years, and I began working on it about 12 years ago and put together the first carbon fuel cell using components from a molten carbonate fuel cell that is normally used for hydrogen. Then things kind of went slow for a number of years, until about 2009, 2010, there was a breakthrough in the understanding of the carbon fuel cell that came from here, from University of Tianjin, in Professor Lee's group. And it was a physical model of how the processes occurred and what to do to help understand how we can get very, very high efficiencies in a fuel cell that consumes not hydrogen, but carbon. And about that same time, I began working with Professor Rob Selman from Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. And we came up with yet another advance, and we brought that together with what I'm now calling the Tianjin model, the Tianjin model, and that has made all the difference. And I'll be describing that today. Okay. Here's an outline. We're going to be talking about the definition and the importance of direct carbon fuel cells. How do you measure efficiency? This has an extraordinary efficiency, which is very close to the theoretical limit allowed by the laws of thermodynamics. How do we measure that? Then we go through the physical model that came from here, and perhaps suggest a couple enhancements of that model. We're going to go through the work that I did with Professor Rob Selman at Illinois Institute of Technology, which explains why some experiments get very, very high efficiencies and others not. And then how to get very high efficiencies out of your carbon fuel cell one time after another consistently. Rob Selman has a model of what happens in a stirred bed of carbon particles in a slurry. It's another way to make a carbon fuel cell. And then the last thing I'm going to talk about is the next steps. And this may interest you if you want to get involved in what may be a very, very important process which will change the way the world does something. Now's the time, and I'll explain what steps might be taken next in a graduate-level research program. Okay, this is what a carbon fuel cell is. I've drawn a box here made out of alumina, ceramic, a solid carbon plate in here, very dense, like as dense as you can make carbon by heating it and compressing it at a high temperature. Down here is what I call the sand barrier. It's actually a collection of particles of aluminum oxide, like grit, like sandpaper. But it's inert in the sodium carbonate electrolyte and provides a good way to separate the carbon anode from the cathode. The cathode down here takes oxygen from the air and reduces it, along with carbon dioxide, to form carbonate. And that completes the circuit. The current flows this way. The electron comes directly off of the carbon, goes the opposite direction. The dense anode can be made of fossil fuels, such as coal or natural gas, or renewable fuels that come from biomass, like wood or forestry products or agricultural products that have been pyrolyzed. The cost of the hardware, as close as we can estimate it, is about $1,000 per kilowatt, which is pretty good. The power that comes out of it will cost somewhere between 3 and 10 cents per kilowatt hour. And finally, The important point, the one that we are certain of now, the one we can actually measure, is that the total or overall efficiency will approach 70 to 80%. That's 70 to 80% of the Gibbs free energy for conversion of the chemical reaction into useful work. There are low-cost materials that can be used in this as well, the graphite, ceramics, and a certain small number of other materials are stable in this environment. Now, why does the world need such a process? Well, to begin with, carbonaceous fuels are widely used and still inexpensive. They contribute major amount of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, however, because they are very inefficient per unit of energy that are produced. Hence, large amounts of carbon dioxide make for a large CO2 footprint for how coal is now generally used, by burning it in boiling water and using the steam to run a turbine. The carbon fuel cell reduces the carbon footprint by a factor of 2.5, 250%, and that makes all the difference. Now it becomes one of the most efficient ways to make electricity. In addition to coal and natural gas and petroleum coke and other sources of fossil carbon, this process works perhaps even better on carbon made by charring biomass, forestry products, agricultural waste, and so forth. And that is a significant advantage. This brings us all into focus on a single chart. Here we have the carbon dioxide intensity, the grams of carbon dioxide per kilowatt hour, versus the efficiency. Here's where most steam plants operate, burning coal, very high emissions, and very low efficiency. Our efficiency is way down here at 70 to 80%, and it's just slightly above this brick wall. This brick wall is the limit allowed by thermodynamics. The absolute limit up here of efficiency of 100% is approached, and we can't get below this level of carbon dioxide intensity, about 500 grams per kilowatt hour, unless we go to something like biofuels, which have no net carbon footprint at all. You bring back as much CO2 as you take out. Okay. The total efficiency equations are given here. I won't go through these. These are in the literature, which you can get off my website, or I can send you copies of it. But basically, it says that here's an equation for the total efficiency or overall efficiency of the process. It's a product of a number of terms like utilization, the effective valence, the voltage, and so forth. And when you go this and through all the definitions, you come down to a very simple equation that relates the overall efficiency or total efficiency to Coulombic efficiency and voltage efficiency. This you measure from the terminals of the fuel cell. This you measure from the number of electrons that are extracted per atom of carbon divided by 4. So if you get all 4 electrons from carbon oxidation that goes to CO2, you have 100% Coulombic efficiency. Okay, what's the experimental basis? All this is tied to reality through experimentation. The Coulombic efficiency is readily determined in the laboratory from the off gases that come from the cell. We'd like them all to be carbon dioxide, but usually there's a mixture of carbon dioxide and some carbon monoxide, which you don't want at all because that destroys that hinders the efficiency of the overall cell. So typically, you'll step current up, let it go for an hour or so, if you reach a certain state, and then you measure the amount of carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide that come off at each stage. Then you use a simple mass balance, like you solve in your final exam in chemical engineering process design. Carbon dioxide, or carbon comes in as carbonate, and carbon comes out as CO2 and CO, and some electrons come out. You solve all this for the ratio of the electrons per carbon, and you have the Coulombic efficiency. That's the other half of the equation for determining the total efficiency of the process. Use these equations down here, and then you get some real data here. Here's the Coulombic efficiency as a function of the current density, and they always rise as the current density increases. There was some work done by Den Shui Yu, I hope I pronounced his name correctly, as a graduate student very recently, was reported this week, where he did a deliberate measurement of this property and found it went from 70 up to about 90 as you approached high current densities of 200. So that confirms what has been in the literature and which we've understood to some extent all along. There's one material for which they measured at the same time the off gas to get Coulombic efficiency and the cell voltage to get voltage efficiency. And that was a sample of Kentucky number 9 coal, bituminous, that was charred and put in the carbon fuel cell. This here is the current efficiency. You see it starts out at 100% at 600 degrees, but that's too low a temperature to operate. And it falls off all the way to 95% at 750 degrees. And you can make a useful process anywhere with these Coulombic efficiencies. You take this data here and combine it with this data here. This is the cell voltage as a function of the current density. And you get what is known as a power curve. It's a plot of electrochemical cell overall efficiency, everything, as a function of the power, number watts per unit area per square centimeter of cell. And this little box up here is 60 to 70% total efficiency. We would like to operate about here. That's about 70% efficiency and about 80 milliwatts per square centimeter. We could just barely make a useful fuel cell with those properties. But this is unusual in that it's one experiment that yielded everything you'd ever want to know about the efficiency of the cell, and it looks very favorable. This work was done by Weaver and Nannis at Stanford Research Institute near Stanford, California, 1979. Okay, there's another altogether different way you can make a carbon fuel cell, which may turn out to be even easier than making a block of carbon, compressing it, and put it into molten carbonate electrolyte. This cell operates at the same temperature. It's about 750 degrees, 700 degrees, roughly in that range. What they do is they grind up the coal, put it into the molten salt, stir it around, and when it stops bubbling and degassing, then they can put a graphite or a platinum rod in there and start drawing current. Every time a particle of carbon hits the platinum rod, it throws an electron, hopefully 4 electrons per carbon atom, into the circuit, and then that is then combined with oxygen in the other electrode. We use a shielded oxygen electrode here so you won't mix the two electrolytes. Then from the off-gas composition, you can determine the Coulombic efficiency. Now this work was done by Zhu and Andrew Dix at Queensland University, as well as by Loutakis in Ohio State University about 10 years earlier. And what they found is that out here in the bulk, most of the carbon is wasted by the Boudoir reaction. Recall that's carbon reacting with CO2 going to produce 2 CO atoms. Molecules. You don't want that to occur. But it occurs everywhere else except just where the carbon particles are touching the surface of the graphite rod. And in fact, if you plot the utilization, that's the fraction of the carbon that's being used to make electricity as a function of the volume to area ratio. That's the ratio of the total volume to the surface area of this electrode. And you go down to very, very small volumes, pretty soon you find that you're above 90% utilization. And in fact, you can get approach 100% utilization, 100% Coulombic efficiency, just by reducing the volume of electrolyte that coats the electrodes. Engineering difficulties there, because now you have to make a very thin cell and force particles through it, but it can be done. Okay. It turns out the cell has to be less than about 3 millimeters thick. Okay, summary. What are the important experimental results to date? The total efficiency is a function of the off-gas composition and the voltage. 80% is found for certain materials at about 100 milliamps per square centimeter. The materials of choice are dense anodes made of coal chars or biocarbon compressed and held together with pitch, or fine particles at the current collector interface in a stirred reactor. The rate is 80% efficiency is determined, however, by disorder. That's the rate. That's how much power you get out of it per unit area. For turbostratic or highly disordered carbons where the carbon matrix is all disordered on the atomic level, you get about 100 milliwatts per square centimeter, maybe 125 if you're really lucky. For very dense graphite, on the other hand, it's a factor of 1,000 times lower, so you can't use graphite as a fuel. Okay, I'd like to turn now to what I've been calling the tension model, in honor of the place that where it was developed. And it starts with a physical model of the carbon lattice. If you've probably seen these things before. They're maybe 100, maybe 300 nanometers across, the little nodules of carbon. And that's what you would find if you looked at particles of graphite or carbon under a scanning electron microscope. They're made of little stacks of plates, of graphene plates. These are the chicken wire. You take a stack here and look at it in this direction. What you see is this. This is a characteristic dimension that you can read out of powder X-ray diffraction patterns. It's a characteristic dimension. They're generally circular, and the rate of carbon dissolution is controlled by what happens at the edges of the plane. In the middle of the plane over in here, nothing much happens because the crystal is too perfect and there's no place where it wants to break and oxidize. But on the edges where you have exposed bonds, that is where the reaction will occur. Reactivity is only at the edges. The spaces between the stacks, these little spaces here, there, and that one right there, those are the pores. They're on the order of 10 nanometers across. The reactive site concentration is the number of open bonds per unit area. So what you would do is you would count the number of bonds here and divide it by the area, and that's your site concentration. The Butler-Volmer kinetics are used in the tension model, and it was scaled to experimental activation data from a single point appropriate to 80 nanometers graphite by Peelen, it's a Dutch group, in the year 2000. Okay, and some of the results of that, you have characteristic domain diameter here. 30 is beginning to look very graphitic, very ordered. It gets even more ordered down here. If you increase the amount of order and you get, say, 30 characteristic dimension, 30 nanometers, it's beginning to look amorphous. And it would really look amorphous if you kept going. So where you want to be is up here someplace to get a high degree of power out of the cell. This is the sequence of 8 steps that were assumed in the model development. There are 2 series of electrons, or there are 4 electrons actually being withdrawn by the time you get to the 8th one. The initiating step is decomposition of carbonate to form oxide, carbon dioxide. This is the oxide which then starts the reaction. It absorbs on a carbon on an active site to produce a charged species. That is oxidized in 2 steps. Electrochemistry, you can only take 1 electron out per step. virtually all the time. And then you get this material here, which looks like carbon monoxide absorbed on the crystal. Then you add a second oxide, it's charged, two more electrons come off, and then finally the CO2 component comes off. Now this is 8 steps, and no rate determining step was assumed. It's not necessary to develop a kinetic equation for this, and there's no reason to assume it. If you can develop an equation, that seems to work. Okay, we're going to miss some data here, but that's okay. We can't translate Microsoft Office 7 to 2003 without losing stuff here and there, but it's very boring anywhere, and it's already in the literature. So this is a plot of the experimental basis to which this theory was tied. This is the plot of the rate of the reaction or the resistance of the reaction versus 1 over temperature, and that data was used to tie the theory to reality. Okay, and then just last couple of things. The overpotential predicted from 3 to 30 nanometers is very reasonable, and it's what the range in which we actually measure overpotential. The overpotential also decreases very slightly at about 750 because there are opposing forces that either increase or decrease the rate as you raise temperature. Okay. Now, all models have limits, things they don't look at. There are a couple of things that need to be explained that aren't explained by the tension model. It does not account for the presence of CO in the product, and we do get some CO under most conditions of operation. The Tafel polarization, which was assumed inherently in using Butler-Volmer kinetics, applies only with graphite. For most things, it doesn't apply. You either get a linear polarization or you get a broken curve. All edge defects were assumed to be equally active. It worked, but it's not necessary to make that assumption. And finally, no rate determining step was identified. You normally determine a rate determining step and then hinge your kinetics to the analysis of what happens going from that step in either direction toward products or toward reactants. Okay? So we might be able to enhance this model, and this work is ongoing. But this is the work that Rob Selman and I did. We looked at literally hundreds, maybe even thousands of polarization curves going back 50 years from many different published papers. We began to notice they all had something in common, or virtually all of them had something in common. They weren't either linear or Tafel, but broken. They had this is a plot of the voltage of the cell versus the current density. As you raise the current density, the voltage dropped very rapidly, then it stopped dropping and decreased at a more gradual rate. Out here, it fell to zero because there was some mass transport limitation or other. And over here, we see the same thing. I turned the axes 90 degrees. But here's the voltage is on this chart here. As you draw current from the cell, the voltage drops very rapidly and then falls off very slowly. We call this segmented polarization curves. And we took a careful look at what happened inside each of the two segments. We found that the low current segment, I call it the LCS, the rate was very strongly dependent on the area inside the particle. These particles are generally porous, and if you sum up all the area, you can do things to vary that amount of area, but the rate is proportional to that area. But at the high current segment, there is very little dependence on flow rate at all. This is an artifact of the way the samples were cut, and really should be ignored. And that dependence was linear. The other thing we found out is that for the high current segment down here, the rate was very strongly dependent on external flow conditions, how fast you're stirring the reactor, how fast the bubbles are coming off and floating up. And whereas at the low current segment, there was much less dependence on flow rate. There was some, but there was much less. In fact, you can draw a line through it. So we came to the conclusion quite quickly that right where you go from the linear segment to the slower varying, you're shifting the location of the reaction from the interior of the carbon electrode, remember it's porous, to the external surface. When you do this, the current density is increasing. In the porous, it's a very low current density, very close to equilibrium, because the given current is distributed over an enormous area of carbon particles. But when you cross that inflection point, the current all flows to the outer surface, the area drops, polarization increases, and lo and behold, you are on the segment of the polarization of the Butler-Volmer kinetics that was described in the tension model. That's a very important result. And what this result shows us is that if we can force the reaction to occur at the outer surface of the electrode and not penetrate through the pores at all, we can force the electrode to operate in a condition where you have pure CO2 product, hence a very high coulombic efficiency, hence a very high overall efficiency. So this is a very significant result. Okay, I won't go into this too much detail because there isn't time, but it's basically the same model. We made a couple of modifications to it. We see that the second absorption occurs and initiates a series of steps which are not invertible. You remember from your kinetics classes, you derive an overall kinetic equation by summing up all the rates going in one direction and then solving that together with all the rates going in the opposite direction. To do that, the steps have to be invertible physically. There are a few chemical reactions known into nature where the steps aren't invertible for some reason. For example, the corrosion of zinc and sulfuric acid, not invertible. Butler-Volmer kinetic work doesn't work there at all. And so we think that what is happening here is that when this CO2 leaves the lattice, part of the lattice at the edge collapses and is no longer a hexagon. But you can't go in the opposite direction. You can't absorb CO2 and open up that five-membered ring and make it a six-membered ring again. It's sterically hindered. And so that changes the character a little bit and allows us to go back here and identify a rate-determining step. Now, I didn't do this entirely on my own. This was assumed to be the rate-determining step in the Alcoa model, which was used to describe the anode in the aluminum-producing process.